Catholic family. 5 mouths to feed.
Only 5?
He turned and leaned on the counter, smiling at her wry wit. There were others, but Ma either miscarried or they died soon after birth. My parents contributed 9 souls to the parish in all. Ma was always philosophical about the one she lost. She has an amazing faith. And he loved her for that. The realization warmed him, even as he set his teeth to continue his story. Anyway, there were 5 of us, and Pop had to work double to keep us in clothes and shoes.
And dirt bikes,
she said softly, and he knew she understood how truly momentous that gift had been. And dirt bikes. Pop always wanted to be a history teacher, but he never got to go to college. He was determined all of us would go to college, and one of us would be the history teacher.
He picked you.
Yes, but I wasn't interested. The tug of fame had me, and I wasn't inclined to fight the pull. I loved the limelight, loved the adulation, the applause. I loved to play ball.
You were young, Max.
Don't make excuses for me, Caroline, he said, more sharply than he'd intended. You weren't there. You can't know. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be terse. I knew my dad wanted me to play, but he also wanted me to have a backup, just in case. I thought he was a foolish old man, too unsophisticated to understand the real world stuck on a farm in Illinois. He didn't understand the world of fast money, fast cars. A ghost of a smile mocked. Shoe deals. None of that mattered to him. He loved his family, though, and he and Ma wanted me to be happy.
So you played ball? Sweet 16? Final 4?
All 4 years. We were good. He shook his head, remembering it all. We were also stupid. My buddies degreed in cop-out majors because we weren't there to study, we were there to play. He watched her brows furrow.
But your resume said you majored in history at UK.
I did. Made it through by the skin of my teeth. I showed up to class for the tests, or if my girlfriend at the time was in the same class. I didn't care about it. I think that hurt Pop more than if I'd majored in basket weaving instead. To have the opportunity and not use it? He sighed as he pushed himself away from the counter and placed 2 glasses of water on the table. So I graduated with the highest honor I could think of, MVP of my senior season, he said, his tone mocking. 2nd-round draft pick for the Lakers. I was on top of the world.
And your father?
His laugh was without mirth. Pop was so proud of me. He should have busted with it. He was worried, I could see, but proud just the same. He and Ma just didn't understand my life. His voice dripped with sarcasm, all for himself. His jaw went taut. I moved to L.A., took up with a fast crowd. I didn't make it home that first year, but I sent money. Paid off Pop's mortgage. Caroline sat watching his face darken at that last revelation. Tentative, she tilted her head forward and verbally tiptoed.
So that wasn't a good thing?
He glared at her, and she could feel the turmoil that churned in his gray eyes, gone harder than steel. I hurt him. Sending him money. When all that mattered to him was me. Paid off his mortgage like it was a big fucking deal. We fought over it. I thought he was ungrateful. He thought I didn't love him anymore. His voice wavered and he cleared his throat. God, that hurt. I never would have hurt my father. But I did. He'd taken his seat again, but his gaze was fixed on a point behind her. She slid her hand under his palm, linking her fingers through his, and said nothing. It was David that brought me back. He'd saved his money from a part-time job and flew out to L.A. the lips that had kissed her so thoroughly thinned to a mere line. "Found a pretty major party going on at my place." He was so disappointed in me. I was so pissed at him, arriving unannounced like that. Then a glimmer of a smile lit his eyes. "The party broke up soon after he got there. Wasn't much use in anyone staying once Dave had thrown all the booze out of the window. He pretended to be a priest of all things, told my so-called friends they'd burn in hell." A chuckle rumbled deep down. He should have stayed in L.A. He would have had an Oscar by now. He glanced over at the stove. I'd get up to turn that again, but I don't think I'd make it to the stove without my cane. Caroline jumped to her feet, took the food off the stove, and set it aside. Maybe she'd have an appetite later. Taking her seat, she nodded.
"Go on."
"So I went home with Dave and made up with Pop. Pop and I came here to Grandma's to be alone, away from the others." He cried. Max stared down at his hands. I'd never seen my father cry before that day, even when Ma lost the babies. He sat right here at this table and cried, and told me he loved me, that he was proud of me. That was probably the most profound moment of my entire life, and I have that, he swallowed hard, as the last thing my father ever said. On our way back home, I slid on some ice and drove my car into a tree and down into a ditch. His hands splayed flat against the table, and he flinched when Caroline placed her smaller hands over his.
"And he died."
She could say it for him. At least that much she could do. "Yes. Thank God it was instantaneous. It would have killed Ma if he'd suffered." He drew a great breath, then let it out quietly. "There were many days I wished I'd died with him." Her heart tightened.
"You were hurt in the accident."
"I was hurt. My back was broken, and I was paralyzed. My career was over. My father was dead, and my mother was a widow."
"And you blamed yourself?"
"Oh, absolutely." He turned his hands over and steepled his fingers with hers before lacing them and holding on. "It was my fault. Even if it wasn't, it was. Still is."
"And?"
Max raised his gaze to find her eyes brimming, and lifted their joined hands to brush her to lower lashes, sending the tears streaming down her face. "Don't cry for me, Caroline." She shook her head.
"I'm not crying for what you are, or even what happened to you. I'm crying for what you felt, laying there in a hospital bed, alone because you thought you had to be."
Astonished, for a moment he could only stare. She'd hit the truth squarely on the head, a truth he'd never disclosed to another soul since the night he left his mother without a husband and his brothers and sisters without their father. "Exactly right," he said slowly. "I was more alone than I'd ever been in my life, and ready to give up." Caroline tried to pull her hand free, but he wouldn't let her go. So she sat and sniffled until he put a napkin in her hand.
"But you didn't give up. What happened?"
"David happened. He wouldn't let me give up. He pushed and prodded and nagged until I went to rehab just to shut him up. It took a long time just to be able to support my own weight, and still I was in a wheelchair." He took a huge swallow of the water at his elbow. "I decided to finally do what Pop wanted."
"You went to Harvard and got your PhD.
Her tears well under control, she regarded him inquisitively.
"How did you get into Harvard, if your grades were so bad at UK?
"Well, I stretched a little there. I never studied, but I managed A's most of the time, B's sometimes.
And that was by the skin of your teeth?
She asked, faintly amused. For me, yes. I used to get straight A's in high school without lifting a finger. It used to make Ma so mad at me.
You'll never learn any responsibility, Max,
she'd say.
She was wrong.
And you're being kind, he returned with a smile and watched her eyes smile back. So, yes, I went to Harvard with my resident roomie David. He went to make sure I did my exercises and all my rehab. Gave up some of the best years of his life to get me walking again.
I'd bet he considers it one of his greatest investments. He seems like a remarkable person.
He is. He liked you. Pleasure filled her eyes.
I'm glad. I'd like to meet the rest of your family someday.
The merest glint of a grin tilted his lips, and some of his sadness drained away. Then come here on Saturday. All my brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews will be here. It's supposed to be a surprise party.
Then how do you know about it?
Ma let it slip yesterday. I have to promise to look shocked. He let his jaw drop and his eyes bug out. How's this? Her airy laugh filled the room, and the pendulum of his emotion swung from melancholy to basic greed in a heartbeat.
I'd say leave the acting to your brother,
she responded, rising to salvage their dinner, then shrieking her surprise when he pulled her onto his lap. Startled, Caroline stiffened when panic grabbed at her. But the fear was fleeting, simply melting away when his mobile mouth took charge once again, sending her deep into the heat of him. She lifted her arms around his neck and freely relinquished any thoughts of dinner or tragedies, allowing herself to absorb the wonder of being so desired by such a man. And that he desired her could not be disputed, the evidence currently pulsing against her hip. His tongue traced the seam of her lips, and resistance never entered her mind. She hummed her satisfaction as he claimed the interior of her mouth as decisively as he'd seized her lips. He twisted, surrounding her, one arm around her waist and the other firmly grasping her upper arm as he pushed the back of her head against his shoulder, and plundered. He couldn't get enough, was the only thought that slipped through the dark haze. He explored every inch of her mouth, inside and out, turned her lips plump and pouty, and it still wasn't enough. His hand needed the softness of her arm, but it was a poor second to the sensation he craved. Her full breasts pressed against his chest, the pebble hardness of her nipples taunting him through the barrier of their clothing. To hold her breasts in his hands had long surpassed mere wanting. It had become a blind compulsion, and his fingers dropped her arm of their own accord, splaying across her ribs until his thumb and forefinger bracketed the full underside of one breast. Her quick gasp made him hesitate. The damn telephone made him stop. Swearing under his breath, he lifted his head, drawing in great gulps of air, feeling as though he'd run a 4-minute mile. She struggled in the circle of his arms.
The phone,
she panted. Let the machine pick it up, he growled.
I can't. It might be Tom. He'll worry.
She struggled again, and he opened his arms with a scowl. Testing her balance, she gripped his shoulder with a trembling hand. Stifling a giggle at his glare, she drew a breath and lifted the receiver.
Hello?
Max watched her face light up and felt his disgruntled attitude dissipate. It was hard to be angry when she was so happy.
Well, it's nice to meet you too, Mrs. Hunter. All right then, Phoebe.
Max winced in mild dread as Caroline's dimples appeared in full relief. She was laughing at him, he thought, eyes narrowing. Revenge would be sweet. The thought cheered him immensely, even as his mother chattered in Caroline's ear.
He's already invited me, but thank you.
Blue eyes danced at his discomfort.
I'm looking forward to meeting the whole Hunter clan.
Chapter 10. Hickory, North Carolina, Thursday, March 8th, 8 p.m.
Step aside, sir.
The sir was tacked on, more afterthought than any show of respect. Winters pressed his back against a wall to avoid the oncoming gurney with its accompanying team of trauma medical personnel. A nurse in bloody scrubs brought up the rear, running just behind the gurney, holding an IV bag high in the air. The gurney with its entourage disappeared behind double-swinging doors. A sobbing woman ran up to the doors, wringing her hands.
"Mrs. Daltrey, please."
Another nurse wearing a smock covered in teddy bears caught the sobbing woman by the shoulders.
"You can't go in there. You need to let the doctors do their job." "Please," the woman sobbed. "She's my baby."
She hunched forward, and the nurse put a comforting arm around the woman's shoulders.
"She'll be so afraid. I don't want her to be afraid." "She's getting the best possible care,"
the nurse soothed.
"Let me find you a place to rest. Are you hurt anywhere?" "No, just Lindsay. Oh, God, there was so much blood. How can she lose so much blood?"
"Shh." The nurse stopped by an uncomfortable-looking chair.
"Sit and try to calm down. Is there anyone I can call for you?"
"No, there's no one."
Dazed, the woman sunk into the chair.
"No one,"
she whispered. With a sympathetic look back, the nurse walked to the station, then assumed her position behind it. Winters looked both ways before crossing the hall and approaching the nurse's station. He cleared his throat, and the nurse with the teddy bear smock looked up. She was in her mid-30s, her dark brown hair dappled with gray. She'd be pretty enough if she dropped 20 pounds. Her name was Claire Burns, and she'd worked in the orthopedic ward at Asheville General for 10 years— up until she transferred 4 years ago. Importantly, she'd been there the same summer as Mary Grace. She was 6th on the list of hospital personnel provided by Randy Livermore, kid hacker extraordinaire. The first 5 had turned up nothing. He had some high hopes for Nurse Burns. She was married to a Hickory-based CPA who'd met her at a charity fundraiser 5 years ago. She'd been working a booth, selling kisses for a dollar. The CPA contributed over $100 to whatever cause she was working for that day. They'd conducted a long-range relationship, and he'd finally popped the question, married her, and moved her to Hickory. They wanted to have a baby, but they'd been totally unsuccessful and had applied for adoption. They always kept their lawn mowed and never left their trash cans out on the street after garbage pickup day. She had very, very chatty friends, both in Asheville and in Hickory. He doubted she'd be pleased at the information he'd obtained without even trying. Her tweezed brown brows rose in greeting.
"Yes? Can I help you with something?"
Winters smiled and smoothed his mustache with his thumb and forefinger. No slippage. Good.
"I hope so. I'm looking for Claire Gaffney."
The woman smiled distractedly.
"That's me. Or at least it was me. Gaffney's my maiden name. Now it's Burns. Excuse me a moment."
She leaned on one foot to look around him. Winters looked over his shoulder to see the mother of the injured child get up and walk toward the double doors to surgery. Nurse Burns opened her mouth, then closed it again as the woman stopped a few feet short of the doors, folded her arms across her chest, and rocked, crying softly.
"I'm sorry,"
Nurse Burns said softly.
"I just hate cases like this. The other guy walked away without a scratch. They got him at a .2 on the breathalyzer."
Her fist clenched as she clutched one lapel of her teddy bear smock.
"I'm glad they took him someplace else."
He'd been first on the scene of enough DUI wrecks to agree with her.
"Will the little girl live?"
She shook her head.
"I don't know."
Then she straightened and folded her hands on the purple semicircular desktop.
"Why are you looking for me? Do I know you?"
"No, you don't. I'm actually looking for a nurse who worked at Asheville General Hospital about 9-10 years ago. I understand you worked there then?
She narrowed her eyes, suddenly on guard.
I did.
He smiled again, sadly this time. Her eyes stayed narrowed. He expected nothing less. Any woman cautious enough to use a club to lock her steering wheel in a protected parking garage and who carried a spray canister of mace on her keychain was bound to be suspicious.
My reasons are completely above board, I assure you. I had a sister. Her name was Jean. Jean died a few months back, and in going through her things, I found a letter addressed to somebody named Christy. I remember her talking about Christy being a nurse at Asheville General around 10 years ago. I'm trying to track her down to give her the letter. I've checked the hospital records, but they didn't have anybody by that name on the roster. I'm wondering if anybody remembers her.
Nurse Burns tilted her head, eyes only slightly less narrowed.
How did your sister know this, Christy?
Jean had gone to live with our grandmother, who was really sick. She met Christy when she took Mama into the hospital for treatments. That would have been summertime 9 years ago.
Nurse Burns' face relaxed.
Okay.
She glanced over at the mother, who was now pacing up and down the hall outside the double doors. Her brows scrunched as she thought.
I don't remember a Christy at Asheville General. We had a Carla and a Carol Ann, but no Christy.
Did you have any other employees named Christy? Any nurses in training, perhaps?
Winters had no idea the name of the woman he was looking for. Christy had been the name of the last hooker he'd arrested for soliciting. Christy had been anxious not to be arrested. They'd worked out a solution agreeable to them both. Very agreeable. Burns shook her head.
No, we did have a summer volunteer that year, though. Her name was Susan Crenshaw. Pretty little thing. Couldn't have been more than 18 at the time. She was going to get her nursing degree. She shadowed the head nurse, Nancy Desmond.
Tiny hairs on the back of Winter's neck came to full alert. Bingo.
Doesn't sound like the person I'm looking for. Did she have a lot of contact with the patients? The woman I'm looking for would have worked in oncology. My grandmother had cancer.
No, Susan worked on our floor, orthopedics. There was another volunteer in oncology that summer, come to think of it. But it was a young man, not a girl.
Susan Crenshaw. Crenshaw wasn't a name on Livermore's list. Of that he was certain.
Well, thank you for your time, nurse.
He glanced over his shoulder. The woman was still pacing at the double doors.
Sorry I couldn't have been more help,
she murmured, her attention already focused again on the distraught mother. You have, Winters thought. Hopefully more than you know. He arrived at his car and slid behind the wheel. He'd been in 5 separate wigs in the last 48 hours. He was hot, tired, and had rubber adhesive stuck to his hairline. Next up, home for a shower. Tomorrow morning, he'd head for the Asheville Public Library. He needed to access telephone listings from 9 years ago. Hopefully Susan Crenshaw's family would be listed. Otherwise, he'd have to get creative. Winters peeled off the mustache and carefully placed it in the box in which he kept his wigs. The wig itself came off next, and he sighed as the air cooled his sweating head. Asheville, Susan Crenshaw, then on to Mary Grace, and Robbie. Chicago, Friday, March 9th, 11 a.m.
Oh, Caroline.
Dana leaned against the iron railing of the tiny bridge that spanned Carrington's duck pond, fanning herself. It was still cold, so they'd escaped to the duck pond, knowing they'd find relative privacy there.
Did you ever get to dinner?
Caroline's face was as flushed as Dana's, despite the wind. Just remembering those moments in his arms, on his lap. She tugged at her muffler, shivering, but not from the cold.
Eventually. But it was ruined. My first attempt at cooking for him was an abysmal failure. I guess he didn't care.
No,
Caroline bit her lip.
And neither did I. And this surprises you?
Well, yeah, I guess. I didn't...
Frustrated, she looked up at Dana's patient face with a frown before turning her aimless gaze to the wind-whipped pond.
I don't even know myself anymore.
Dana was quiet for a long moment.
I remember my first time with a good man,
she finally said quietly, and Caroline jerked her eyes back to Dana's face. It wasn't a topic that they'd ever broached before.
His name was Lawrence, and he was one of Chicago's finest.
Dana went on, and Caroline instantly felt her whole body go tense. Dana sighed.
Relax, Caro. Not all cops are bad. In fact, most are very good. Lawrence was one of the good guys. He knew about Charlie.
Caroline felt the cold now. The earlier warmth she'd experienced reliving those incredible moments in Max's arms was gone, chased away by the specter of a violent man in a uniform, his badge shiny to the eye, tarnished to the heart. But Dana was talking about her own violent ex-husband, something she rarely did, so Caroline made herself listen.
How did he know about Charlie? One of the guys in his precinct answered my 911, testified when Charlie's case came up in court. He told Lawrence most of the black and white details. It made a difference, Lawrence's knowing. He was so patient with me. I think when the time finally came, he was more scared than I was that he'd do the wrong thing. But he was perfect. Gentle. I never knew that sex didn't hurt. I never knew I could ever like it.
Dana finished quietly. Caroline worried her lower lip.
Or that you could even want it? That too. So what happened to him? Lawrence? We drifted apart, I suppose. He ended up moving out west, Albuquerque. I still get a card from him at Christmas. Oh? Signed by his wife. Oh. Something lasting just wasn't meant to be for the two of us. But that isn't my point here. A physical relationship with the right man is a beautiful thing. Forget what you've ever known, Caroline. If Max is the right guy, well, then...
She shrugged eloquently, then lifted a brow.
That is, if he can. The accident didn't... No.
The word was out before Caroline could even think, and the heat in her face returned with a vengeance, making her tug at the muffler that wound around her neck.
I mean, we didn't. We only... Darn it, Dana, stop laughing at me. Oh.
Dana wiped tears of mirth from her eyes with one mittened hand as the other pressed hard to her chest.
That air is cold. It hurts too much to laugh. Oh, you should see yourself, Caroline. You're blushing like you were caught necking under the back steps by his mother. Not too far from the truth,
Caroline muttered under her breath.
Excuse me?
Caroline lifted her chin with a little toss of her head that had Dana grinning anew.
We were necking, and very adeptly, I might add. Oh, by all means, add away.
Caroline narrowed one eye dangerously.
Watch your step, Dupinsky. Anyway, then his mother called. She's a very charming woman. Whatever. So how do you know the accident didn't, you know?
Caroline rolled her eyes and sucked in a breath, letting it out on an audible sigh.
You don't say.
Dana patted her heart.
Down, girl.
Caroline sobered.
I'm meeting them all tomorrow. Who? His family. Sorry, my mind was still back at, you know.
Dana chuckled at Caroline's frosty glare.
Relax, Caroline. You'll be fine. Everybody loves you.
She draped an arm across Caroline's shoulders and gave her a squeeze.
But take some baked goods just to make sure.
Caroline didn't smile. Unwelcome doubts were now intruding. reality usually was a bitch.
Does it really matter if they like me, Dana? Does it really matter if he is the right guy?
Dana's smirk abruptly vanished.
What are you talking about? It can't work.
Caroline pulled away and walked to the other side of the bridge. Dana followed, glowering.
I don't know why I even let it go this far. Maybe because he is the right guy.
Dana lifted a hand to Caroline's shoulder. Caroline shrugged Dana's comforting hand away.
Two damn pieces of paper. A real marriage license and a fake birth certificate. I wish I could burn them both. Then do it. It wouldn't do any good. Then don't do it.
Caroline wheeled around, fists on her hips, her temper coming dangerously close to boiling over.
Whose side are you on, anyway?
Dana met her eyes, and Caroline felt her anger abruptly deflate.
Yours,
Dana answered soberly.
I've always been on your side. I'm wondering right now whose side you're on.
Caroline's shoulders sagged.
What am I gonna do, Dana?
Dana folded her arms across her chest.
You're asking my advice?
She asked archly.
Yes, damn you.
But Caroline smiled, spoiling the effect.
I'm asking your advice.
Dana sighed.
You risked everything for a new life, Caroline. You planned it so carefully, every little detail of your escape. You wanted freedom from a man who threatened to kill you every day, who almost succeeded twice.
Caroline arched her brows.
More like 5 or 6 times. I lost count after the first 2. I guess you had to be there.
Dana chuckled softly.
I guess so.
Her expression hardened.
He tried to kill you when you tried to get help. Didn't anyone in your town think it was the least bit strange when you filed a complaint against your husband, and the next thing you're falling down the stairs? No? Damn straight, no. Of course, no. It was no the last time and the time before. And guess what, Caroline?
Dana wagged a finger under Caroline's nose, but the impact was lost in her mitten.
It will still be no next week and next year. If you'd stayed, he would have killed you. And then, and only then, would the town have cried crocodile tears. And you know I'm right.
Caroline tilted her head, her brows taking a quick ride up and down.
You're right. Sure I'm right.
Dana inhaled sharply, wincing at the cold air.
I'm always right. You're a fathead. But I'm a fathead who's right. Carol, listen to me. Listen to yourself. You tried to go the right way. You tried to use the law, but nobody listened to you. You're lucky you were able to even get away after that last tumble. How long were you in the hospital? 3 months? That was a long time to leave Tom alone with an abusive man, wasn't it?
Caroline shuddered, remembering the terror of every day of every one of those 3 months. Lying there, helpless, obsessing about what Rob could be doing to her baby. Seeing the fear in her son's eyes every time he came to visit.
Stop. You're right. I was justified in getting away, no matter what means I used.
She drew herself to her full height, still 5 inches shorter than Dana.
But that still doesn't make bigamy right. I'm still married to him, Dana. And on that, I'm right.
Dana caught her by the muffler as she tried to walk away.
Who are you?
Caroline felt her skin prickle at the combatant look in Dana's brown eyes.
What do you mean?
She asked uneasily.
I mean, who are you? What is your name?
Caroline swallowed.
Caroline Stewart. And where is Mary Grace Winters?
She swallowed again. This one more painful than the first as her throat began to close.
Gone.
Dana tugged Caroline's muffler.
And who made her disappear?
When Caroline said nothing, Dana tugged harder.
Damn it, Carol, who made her disappear? I did.
She had. She alone had taken the step to end the pathetic existence of the creature she'd been. To protect herself and the child the law didn't care about.
I did,
she thought again. Dana's eyes were intense.
And now for the $100,000 question. Who will it help if you continue to hold on to the life you worked so hard to escape?
Caroline pulled free and turned away from Dana's piercing gaze. Dana was right. Caroline knew it in her head. Now she had to accept it in her heart. But what was in her heart? She didn't know. It had been less than a week since he'd walked into her office and stolen her breath. But had he stolen her heart? That was a much more difficult question to answer. Conversely, had she stolen his? And if so, would it make a difference to him that she'd been married? That she still was? If it mattered, he wasn't the right man. And she wanted him to be. Desperately. Dana stood waiting patiently as Caroline finished her internal debate.
You're right, Dana. I won't be helping anyone if I ignore what I feel for Max. I'll let this progress where it will. But I won't marry him, should he ask.
Dana huffed her displeasure.
You're letting fear drive your decisions. Big mistake, Caroline. Then it's my mistake to make.
Caroline returned sharply.
Of course, assuming the man still wants me when he learns my history.
Dana's mouth dropped open.
You'll tell him then? Wouldn't you?
Dana closed her mouth.
It's risky. Eli used to say nothing worthwhile is without risks.
Caroline tightened her muffler against the biting wind, and together they started back for the shelter of the history building. Dana stopped in her tracks.
You didn't say better safe than sorry. I'd say that's progress.
Caroline gave her a sideways look. Dana was quite right. Maybe it was because Max made her feel safe. With a shrug, she continued up the hill.
I'm not going to lighten my hair. I said progress, not a miracle.
Asheville, Friday, March 9th, 2 p.m. Ross placed her coffee cup on the only empty space on her desk.
So what do you have?
Stephen opened his folder. Not a hell of a lot. We know that Farrell suspected Rob Winters 7 years ago. We know that there was a good amount of documentation evidence that no longer exists. Photos, statements by nurse and staff, the restraining order that was never officially filed. He handed Ross a packet of photographs. I was able to get reproductions of the pictures. Nurse Desmond died a few years back, but her husband is still alive and very talkative. I spent a good part of yesterday afternoon with him. Stephen grimaced. Damn near talked my ear off, but I got what I needed. Mr. Desmond said his wife kept negatives. She documented patients' history, especially women she thought were enduring abuse. All 15 of the original photos are there, plus about 20 Nurse Desmond never gave to Farrell. Ross opened the packet and flipped through the first few photos, then closed her eyes for a moment.
Sweet Jesus,
she whispered.
I never get accustomed to seeing what humans can do to each other.
Human in the most clinical of terms, of course. Stephen muttered.
Of course.
Ross spread the pictures across her desk, laying them on top of piles of files.
This one.
She tapped one of the pictures with her fingernail.
A burn?
On her neck, Stephen said quietly. They appear to be cigarette burns. He watched her flip through the photos, revulsion clear on her face. Does Winters smoke, Lieutenant? She nodded.
Camel filters.
Ross picked up another photo and bit the inside of her jaw.
Dear God in heaven,
Her back looks like she slept on a wicker basket.
Stephen held his shoulders rigid. Those wounds were likely inflicted by the metal end of a belt, but it would have to have been purposely sharpened to create lacerations that deep. He had to swallow back the bile that rose in his throat every time he saw that picture. She was beaten severely, several times to leave scars like that.
Could they have happened before she was married to Rob?
Ross asked, unable to take her eyes from the graphic pictorial evidence of Mary Grace Winters's abuse. Stephen shrugged. It's possible. Unlikely. Some of those cuts are recent. He pointed to a series of jagged cuts with the end of his pen. These still have red puffy edges. They were probably inflicted less than a week before she entered the hospital after her fall down those stairs. He punctuated the word in the air, a sneer twisting his mouth. Ross sighed.
Let's talk about the night she fell down the stairs.
Pushed, Stephen muttered. Ross shook her head.
As I recall, he had an alibi for that night, Thatcher.
Stephen frowned. I know. He drew another folder from his briefcase and blew off the remaining layer of dust. I got the duty rosters for that night. Your duty rosters from 9 years ago were stored in a warehouse clear across town, waist high in dust. Did you know that? Anyway, Winters was on duty that night. Here are his logs listing all the calls he responded to that night. Most of the night, he was at least 20 miles from his house.
Did he stop to eat that night?
Ross asked. Stephen shrugged. He clocked out for an hour, but there's no telling where he could have gone.
And the restraining order?
Ross held out a hand for the folder. Stephen handed it to her. I got a copy from Farrell. He kept copies of all the paperwork. There's no sign of it here or at the county courthouse.
Then we have an issue in records,
Ross responded, her lips tight.
I'll get an internal investigation started right away.
Good. But I still want to talk to that legal aid attorney. I'm working on locating him. Ross handed back the copy of the restraining order.
Now for the big question. Where's our grieving daddy?
Stephen's brow lifted. Sue Ann Broughton says he's been gone since Wednesday.
You think she's telling the truth?
Stephen shook his head. I don't know. She's a hell of a lot more afraid of him than she is of us. Ross frowned.
None of this has any direct connection to the disappearance of his wife and son, you realize.
Stephen acknowledged her point with a nod. But it will go to show intent, he said thoughtfully.
Only if you can get anything to take to the DA on the known crime at hand, the disappearance of his wife and son.
Ross argued. She pulled the photos together and slid them back in the folder.
You may be able to accuse him of spousal abuse, but you can't prove he did it.
Stephen dropped the folder into his briefcase. Not yet. He flashed Ross a grin. See you on Monday. I got a date with a bass boat with a depth finder and a GPS this weekend. Ross's lips quivered.
Does a woman happen to come with this boat?
Stephen's smile vanished. He'd almost been able to forget about young Susanna Mendelson. Only if I can't convince her daddy to come instead. Raleigh, North Carolina, Saturday, March 10th, 2 p.m. Winters had taken a little break in his surveillance of Susan Crenshaw, who he'd found in the city of Greenville, about a 2-hour drive from Raleigh. He was on a proactive information-gathering mission, spurred by Ben Jolly's continued reports of Stephen Thatcher asking questions. Lots of questions. To people who didn't like him very much. Winters needed some insurance. He sat in his car watching the White House with blue shutters. The mailbox was an enormous large-mouthed bass, its hinged mouth open, just waiting for the mailman. The name Thatcher was stenciled on the post along with the address. White curtains hung at the open windows, blowing a little in the mild March breeze. 3 bicycles were lined up on the tidy front porch, one still with training wheels. He He watched as the front door opened, and an older lady walked out with a little red-headed boy. The boy strapped on a helmet and climbed on the bicycle with the training wheels. He looked over his shoulder, and seeing Winters sitting in his car, waved cheerily. Cute kid, Winters thought. Chatty, too. Special Agent Stephen Thatcher should be home teaching his kid not to talk to strangers instead of digging up ancient history from old has-beens like Gabe Farrell and that poor bastard who was married to the sanctimonious nurse Desmond. Yeah, little Nicky Thatcher was entirely too trusting. He watched the old woman and the little boy head down the street, little Nicky pedaling furiously. The boy was likely to get hurt someday. He'd been very helpful, the little guy. Winters had been pretending to change his tire, and Nicky hadn't been able to resist his own curiosity. Told him his daddy sometimes changed tires, that his mommy had gone to live with the angels, that his daddy had gone on a fishing date with a beautiful queen. Winters hadn't been able to interpret that last part. But then Nicky went on to tell him where he went to school, his teacher's name, and that he hated the broccoli the school served at lunch. So now Winters knew where he could find Thatcher's most prized possession between the hours of 8 and 2, Monday through Friday. He tucked the information away, keeping it for the day Thatcher got a little too close. Tricky business, threatening cops. But just like other people, all cops had their buttons. Winters specialized in finding the best buttons to push and the best time to push them. Thatcher's button was a 6-year-old freckle-faced red-headed boy named Nicky. Ta-da! Chapter 11. Chicago, Saturday, March 10th, 6 p.m. He'd missed it. Max hadn't realized how much he'd missed the bustle, the laughter, the sheer noisiness of it all. They'd gathered, as the boisterous horde they were, Peter and his wife Sonia, Kathy and her husband David, and Elizabeth. Ma was in heaven with her 10 grandchildren surrounding her. The older boys had started a game of touch football out in the yard, and Caroline's son Tom was out there with them. Caroline had fallen in with his sisters as though she'd known them for years. Kathy and the other women dragged her away before the first round of introductions was complete.
"Guess you're chopped liver,"
Ma had commented with a chuckle. Kathy and Liz had barely kissed him hello, but that was okay. There would be plenty of time for renewal of those relationships. He was home now. He'd stayed on the first floor when the others had tramped down the stairs to the basement recreation room, needing a few moments to process the joyous welcome, to calm the roller coaster of emotions that threatened to break his composure. He stood in his living room, basking in a glow that enveloped like a warm blanket. Conversation floated from downstairs, where everyone gathered around a roaring fire. His brothers had ESPN turned up loud, but he could still hear Kathy trying to assemble a crowd for Pictionary. He raised a brow when David loudly claimed Caroline as his partner and decided his momentary respite was finished. David could get his own Pictionary partner. Caroline is mine, he thought. Astonishment at the thought made him pause mid-step. Mine? It was primal, old-fashioned, spontaneous. He wanted her to be his. Desperately. He was so tired of being alone. His hand was on the railing, his foot on the top step, when the sound of shattering glass pierced the air, followed by hushed whispers. Muttering a mild curse, Max turned for the kitchen to investigate.
Hurry!
A childish voice whispered back,
I'm trying, Justin, I'm trying! Hurry, Petey. We need to hurry before Uncle Max catches us.
Max walked to the kitchen to find two of Peter's sons clumsily sweeping the remains of a vase into a dustpan, flowers and water strewn around their feet. The older peeked up from his crouched position on the floor, his expression one of open dismay, and, Max thought with a frown, maybe a little fear.
Petey didn't mean to break the vase, Uncle Max, really.
Justin said, trying unsuccessfully to clear the mess from the floor. At 8, his housekeeping skills left a lot to be desired. It was fear. 4-year-old Petey was cowering against the cabinet, his eyes wide and terrified, clutching a wilted flower in a chubby fist. Max lowered himself to one knee, using his cane for support, as dismayed as his nephews. It's okay, boys. Really. He grabbed the dustpan. I'll hold. Justin, you sweep. It's okay, Petey, he repeated calmly, and watched both boys ease a little.
You're not mad?
Petey whispered. No, Petey, of course not. It's only old glass. Come here. And he watched as the little boy inched closer, his little shoulders tensing again until Max pulled him close in a hug. It's no big deal. Just be careful not to walk around here without shoes until your brother and I clean up the mess. Max held little Petey against his side, maneuvering the dustpan until all the glass was swept, then drew the little boy to stand before him. Even on one knee, Max towered over the child. Petey, he began, trying to keep his voice gentle. Why were you afraid?
He was afraid you'd be mad, Uncle Max.
Justin toed the floor, his eyes on his feet. Why would he think that? Max asked, his voice sharper than he'd intended, and Petey took a step back. I'm sorry, Petey. Why did you think I would be mad? Petey's gaze dropped to the floor, and Justin put a protective arm around his shoulders.
Because you're irritable, Uncle Max,
Petey said, his voice very small, his body pressed up against his brother's.
Like when I don't have a nap.
Irritable? A denial sprung to his lips, but died as Max looked at himself through the eyes of a 4-year-old. The last 12 years of his life had been one long stretch of irritable. The childish words stung. Knowing it was true stung even worse.
And shh, Petey.
Justin started to pull him away. No, Justin, it's okay. Go ahead, Petey.
And you don't like little boys.
Max drew a breath, reeling from the childish honesty. In the few times he'd come home for holidays over the years, he must have seemed like a cross between Captain Ahab and Oscar the Grouch. Time to push the old Max aside. Well, Petey, I can see how you might have thought that. He could see Justin's eyes grow round and Petey peek up from beneath the red hair that fell over his little forehead. I suppose I was grouchy, and you maybe thought it was because I didn't like little boys, but that wasn't true.
He wasn't?
Nope. The truth was, I didn't like myself. Petey chanced a full glance, and Max made his mouth curve into a smile he didn't feel.
What did you do bad so you didn't like yourself?
Justin asked, sucked in. For a moment, Max was speechless, unable to pinpoint the answer himself. I was mad because I had to walk with a cane, he finally answered. Petey nodded sagely.
And your shoulder must hurt, too.
Max's brows drew together in a mild frown. Why would my shoulder hurt?
Daddy says you have a chip on your shoulder the size of a mountain.
He stared in curiosity, but saw nothing more than his uncle's broad shoulder encased in a wool sweater.
Carrying it around must have hurt.
Max pressed his fingers to his lips and rubbed the rueful smile from his mouth. Out of the mouths of babes, he thought. It did, Petey. I'm glad it's gone now. I really appreciate this welcome home party. Thank you very much.
We didn't do anything, Uncle Max,
Justin insisted.
Mom and Aunt Kathy did it.
But you did. Max pulled Petey close and hugged him again. You came to celebrate with me, and I appreciate it. I remember all the parties we had here when I was your age. Max chuckled at Petey's dubious expression. Yes, I was once your age, believe it or not. We'd have cake and ice cream and scream at the top of our lungs.
With Grandma Hunter,
Justin said, his freckled face now sad.
I don't remember her,
Petey confessed. Well, I do, Max said, and tousled Petey's red hair. He'd never believed his sister-in-law's hair was naturally that red until Sonya and Peter reproduced it in every one of their six children. My grandma used to have a trunk full of toy soldiers up in the attic. Your dad and Uncle David and I played with them a lot, especially on days like this when it was too nasty to play outside. Petey's lower lip trembled.
The big boys are playing outside. They won't let us play.
That's probably for the best, Max told him, never taking his eyes from the child's face. It was something small he remembered his own father doing. Undivided attention and unbroken eye contact, even with the smallest child. It had made him feel like he was the smartest, most important boy in the world. Seeing Petey's eyes warm, Max knew it still worked. The big guys would probably knock you down, and that would hurt. But I bet those toy soldiers are still in the attic. I can't get up those stairs real well, but you two can. They were already running for the attic. They were in an old black trunk, Max called after them, waiting until they were out of sight, before struggling to his feet and emptying the dustpan. That was nice, Max. Max didn't turn around at the sound of Peter's deep bass, even gruffer than normal. He hadn't heard his brother approach, but it didn't take a genius to know Peter had heard the whole conversation, had stood waiting to step in should his grouchy brother become irritable with his smallest children. You're good boys, Peter. You and Sonya have done a good job. They stood in awkward silence for a minute, Max staring at the vegetable wallpaper, Peter staring at Max's rigid back. Finally, Peter let out a huge sigh. I'd apologize for them, Max, but they were right. Could it be that were is the operative word here? He added, his voice roughening just a bit more. Clearing the constriction from his throat, Max lifted one shoulder in a half shrug. I'd like to think I don't scare small boys anymore. Max. Peter took the first step, lifting a tentative hand to Max's back. I didn't believe David when he said you'd changed. But I want to. He too cleared his throat. I really want to. I want things to be the same as they were before. Peter didn't finish the sentence, but Max's memory finished it for him. Before you killed Pop? It had been one hell of an argument, 4 years ago last Christmas. Peter's previously unspoken accusation finally became spoken that night, and it was the last time they'd exchanged any words at all. Until tonight. I'm sorry, Max, Peter whispered harshly. I said things I shouldn't have that night. Can we put it behind us and start again? After a beat of silence, Peter removed his hand from Max's shoulder. Okay. Have it your way. At least I tried. For the record, I'm glad you're home. Another long silence hung between them while Max struggled for his composure. Oh, to hell with it, Max muttered and turned, his emotions naked on his face. I'm glad I'm home, too. I missed this, all of you, and I was a stupid fool to stay away so long. A slow grin took Peter's face, a look of pronounced relief in his eyes.
So now we kill the fatted calf, for the prodigal son has returned?
Max's lips twitched.
Well, not that prodigal. I'll be the judge of that.
He threw an arm around Max's shoulders, 6 inches taller than his own.
After you tell me all about Denver and actresses and, secretaries.
Max's eyes narrowed. David has a big mouth.
Peter's husky laugh vibrated as they started down the stairs.
And it's been running on overdrive, little brother.
We're tied.
Phil stood in the makeshift end zone, panting, his breath making huge clouds. He was the oldest cousin and had made himself the leader of the group. Tom didn't really care. He was just grateful there were kids his age at this party his mom dragged him to. It was cold and wet outside, but for the moment, he didn't have to listen to his mom's new boss. He grimaced. His mom's new boyfriend. It would be too weird to even think about his mom that way, even if he liked Max Hunter. Which Tom did not. Seeing his grimace, Phil yelled over,
"You want to stop?" "No way."
Tom leaned over, braced his gloved hands on jeans wet from tackling and tumbling in the slushy snow.
"I want to win." "I'm cold,"
Jason protested. He was a little younger than the others.
"I'm going inside for some hot chocolate."
He tossed a snowball at his cousin's shoulder.
"You coming, Zach?"
Phil's brother Zach looked at Jason and back to Tom, torn.
"Sorry, Tom. I'm going to quit while I still have feeling in my toes. Come on in. Aunt Kathy makes the best hot chocolate in the universe." "With those little marshmallows?"
Tom tucked the football under his arm and began to walk back with the other boys, pleased at having discovered a hidden talent for tossing spirals. The boys had been duly impressed with his status of junior varsity starter on the basketball team, so he felt he'd had little to prove by winning at the expense of frostbite.
"And whipped cream."
Jason licked his lips, then immediately wiped them dry when the wind burned them.
"From scratch?"
Tom asked.
"Nah," said Philip. "One of those cans. My mom makes it from scratch."
And if a little pride stole into his voice, Tom could live with it. He understood how rare his mother truly was.
"From scratch? No way."
Phil approached the end of the driveway, where a 15-foot pole stood alone, cemented into the ground. Pretending to dribble, he turned a fast circle, faked to the left, and executed a perfect air dunk.
"You think Uncle Max will ever put the backboard back up?"
"I don't know,"
Jason answered, studying the top of the pole thoughtfully.
"My mom hopes so. She cried when she asked him to come home and he said yes."
Intrigued, Tom eyed the pole as well.
"Why'd he take the backboard down?"
Phil stopped in his tracks.
"You don't know? Uncle Max was one of the best rookies the Lakers ever had. Went MVP at Kentucky, too."
Tom's eyes widened, impressed in spite of his pledge to keep the tall professor at arm's length until he trusted him with his mother.
"Your uncle played for the Lakers?"
Zach jumped in, eager to share part of the story.
"Yeah, until he was in a car accident with our grandfather. Oh, 12 years ago, Phil?"
Philip nodded.
"Yep. You've seen his cane. He was in a wheelchair for years. My dad told me Uncle Max came home from Harvard one time and threw a fit that the backboard was still there. Made Grandma Hunter take it down."